behind the wheel, under the hood, and beyond with Car Stuff from HowStuffWorks.com.
Hi, and welcome to Car Stuff. I'm Scott Benjamin.
Good day. I'm Ben Bullen.
Oh, Ben, nice. A little down under accent, huh?
Oh, let's not get in trouble at the start of the podcast. I promise I will not try to do an Australian accent because I am horrible at it.
Oh, fair enough. Okay, and I won't attempt said accent either. But today's topic is definitely Australian, and that is that's by design, really, because we've got a couple of listener suggestions for this topic in the past, and one of them comes from an Aussie who says, we'll tell you what, that's the second letter I want to read. The first one I want to read is from someone who suggested the same thing right around the same time. The first one is from Lee Nanton, and Lee is in the military. He was stationed in Germany at the time. Now, these come from, oh, boy, Ben, this is kind of embarrassing. They come from 2011, the end of 2011.
Deep cuts.
They've been on the official Car Stuff to-do list, I guess, since the end of 2011. man, that's a big list. We've really got a huge group of topics coming up that, man.
Hey, in our defense, what this means, for everybody listening out there, if you have written us and we have heard your topic, we are getting to it. We do address every single piece of mail we can get our hands on. We're not able to do it as quickly as we would like to sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of an extreme case. This is like a year and a half backlog on this one, right? I mean, it normally doesn't take that long. It just kind of sat on the list for a while, but we're getting around to it.
Yeah.
Lee Nathan says that he wants to hear about a series that they call, what they sometimes call NASCAR Down Under or NASCAR of Australia. And I guess, well, he's at it. He wanted to kind of, and he has nothing to do with the series, by the way, but he said he just wants to maybe drum up a little bit of interest in the series in the States because, and worldwide, really.
Mm-hmm.
But, because it's typically called an international series, but up until this year, up until 2013, they hadn't raced in the United States, and now they have.
Mm-hmm.
So we're, of course, behind the curve on promoting that race, but I'll tell you about that later. Hopefully Lee's hope was that they'll return in 2014. We had a similar request from another listener, and this one kind of in a roundabout way came about. The listener's name is Dallas Lee, and Dallas is an Australian listener from Brisbane, Australia. And Dallas and I had a little back and forth conversation where Dallas said that, you know, I'd like to hear more about some Australian market topics, you know, anything about the Australian car market. We've got, you know, three major car companies that are still producing cars here. They've got Ford Australia, Holden, which is a subsidiary of GM, and then Toyota Australia as well. And just kind of wanted more Australian topics. And we did that with the road trains.
Yep.
And I think we've had something else. There was another Australian topic. But we started talking a little bit about the Ford Falcon back and forth.
Right, because this was about our animal car episode, right?
Exactly, yeah. You mentioned, hey, I can't believe you guys forgot to mention the Ford Falcon. And I said, oh, well, I actually have a Falcon in my past. My mom had one in the 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And he sent back something with, well, they're still building it. And he said, as a matter of fact, they still use it in the supercar or the V8 supercar series. And that sparked my interest right there. And I said, well, you know what? That's a fantastic idea right there. We'll talk about the V8 supercar series, which is, by all accounts, that's an Australian race series, right?
I mean, right. Yes. The V8 supercar championship. It is an Australian motorsport through and through. Now, as you mentioned, these letters came from 2 years ago, right?
So, yeah, and they were pretty close in timing. I mean, like October and November of 2011.
Oh, okay. So, hey, we're under 2 years then, my friend.
Yeah, it's a little over a year and a half.
Yeah, a little over a year. Look at us.
I'm kind of embarrassed about this, but again, it's a huge list of topics we've got.
Yeah, and we wanted to thank Lee and Dallas. You guys, we're taking up the advice, the suggestions here, and this is going to be our podcast on V8 supercars. Now, one thing, if it's okay to say this, right off the top,
mm-hmm.
Technically speaking, the V8 championship here is international because I think it was in 2013, this year, there are events in New Zealand and in the United States.
That's right.
Yep. There's okay, I'm going to take the New Zealand one, all right?
Sure.
The ITM 400 Pokekohe. I don't know.
I'm glad you said it, not me. But it actually goes more than to more than just New Zealand and the United States as well. I mean, they're in South Australia, they're in Tasmania. Mm-hmm. You mentioned New Zealand, Western Australia. They're in Texas this year in the United States.
Yeah, the Circuit of the Americas. Right?
That's right. And they were in the Northern Territory in Australia again, Queensland. South Wales, New South Wales. Mm-hmm. So they're kind of all over the place. They've actually got 38 races in 14 different venues in Australia, New Zealand, and in the U.S. And I think they had an event, a while back that was in China. But I believe that, for whatever reason, the series didn't go back to China. I don't know if it wasn't popular there. I don't know if it just didn't work out with the promoters or what.
Or maybe it was like a one-off.
That's possible, yeah. But, I mean, I think that was a couple of years ago, and that's no longer part of the series.
Oh, okay, I see. And also, this is a big deal for everybody just hearing about this in the right now on this podcast. The V8 Supercar Series broadcast into 137 countries.
Yeah, it's pretty big.
Yeah, which is pretty big. But what I think we'd like to do is maybe our usual MO, Mr. Benjamin. What do you think? Talk about what it is, where it came from?
Yeah, let's do that. And if you don't mind, I'll just read through kind of a laundry list, and you can stop me whenever you want with questions or whatever you have, okay?
Awesome.
All right, so basically the category of racing that this is. It's a touring car series that, you know, a lot of people may be familiar with touring car in Britain, maybe a little bit here in the United States because there was a North American Touring Car Championship for a short time in the mid-90s. Very similar in design to that, very similar style cars, well, except for the engines, which we'll talk about in a moment. Now, the first season for this this event was in 1997. And I'll talk about how that formulated, how that grew as we get along here. Again, it's an Australian series, extremely popular, and the attendance stats attest to that because an average event, the attendance is somewhere over 100,000 people.
Right, and for some of the bigger events, it can be that can peak over 250,000.
A quarter of a million people for a couple of these big, you know, like major endurance events, or you know, the events that go over several days.
Mm-hmm.
Again, based in Australia, it's an international series that's run under FIA regulations. And man, it's got a long, long history. These cars are loosely based on four-door, street-legal, what they call saloon cars.
Right, yeah. And these, they have some rules about control components to make sure that these varying makes of car are still on somewhat of a level playing field. To go back a little bit before 1997, this started, the idea at least, started with Fords and Holdens. For the Australia Touring Car Championship, with V8 engines, and this competition grew from a Group 3A designation, with, you know, Class A being the 5-liter V8 engines, Ford and Holdens, competing, moving up through some new rules, and ultimately, I should mention there was also Class B, which would be 2-liter cars, and a Class C. And these eventually start working in the 1993 Australian Touring Car Championship. And they had two classes for some of the other events that would be just over 2,000cc and then 2,000cc and below. Anyway, so let's fast forward to 1995, the 2-liter cars had their own series of super touring cars, and that made them ineligible for the Australian Touring Car Championship.
Yeah. Now, you mentioned that this was pretty much set up for Ford and GM with their Holden vehicles. The Falcon and the Commodore, I think, were the vehicles that they used, and they still do.
Yep.
But the series was really set up so that it kind of conformed to what they were already producing in their street cars, and, you know, they're producing these big four-door, you know, we mentioned saloon cars. I should just say that, you know, for the rest of the world, besides our UK listeners, you know, the Brits and the Irish English, that's what they call a sedan. So a lot of us will call a saloon car a sedan and vice versa.
Yeah, It's kind of just a difference of language.
And before you get too down on this, saying that, you know, it's a four-door sedan, I don't really care to see that race. Listen to some of the stats that we'll tell you about these things, and they're pretty remarkable. Mm-hmm. They're incredibly fast. I've had experience, like on track experience, with the North American touring cars, and they were 2-liter cars with the Dodge Stratus team when they were running back in the mid 90s, mm-hmm. and incredibly fast, incredibly exciting. It's really close racing. It's really, really remarkable. It's fun to watch, and it's usually run as a support series to, or it was run as a support series to, you know, like maybe the kart series back when it was running, mm-hmm. In the mid 90s again. But this V8 Supercar series, this is its own, this is the big event. And there's a spin-off series called the Dunlop V8 Supercar series that I'm going to talk about also in a moment. Okay. But, again, I just want to kind of quickly get through some of these quick stats on this thing.
Sure.
Now, the chassis, of course, that's a control, part. And we say control, that means the parts that are formulated by the series that say that it has to be identical for everybody.
Yes.
It's kind of like NASCAR, you know, when they say here's our template for your vehicle and here's what you have to adhere to. Mm-hmm. Similar in that you know, all the chassis are going to be the same. They're going to have a little bit of variation here and there just for the different body styles, but the control parts we talk about, that's what we mean. They're mm-hmm. They're mandated by the series. So there's a control chassis. They're front engine, rear, they're all front engine, all rear wheel drive cars. And they're all 5-liter V8 engines, of course. I mean, as you would expect in a V8 supercar series. normally aspirated, so there's no turbos involved at all. And they all use a 6-speed sequential transaxle. And, the transaxle thing is kind of new too, because that is, transaxle. I mean, obviously that's a differential and the gearbox all in one assembly. So that's what makes that different. Man, I've got a list of control parts. So should we talk about, I don't know if we should go to the Dunlop V8 supercar series first, or maybe talk about the history of the V8s?
Yeah, let's see. I've got a couple stats, and then let's do history of the V8s.
Sure.
And then go to Dunlop and the development stuff.
You got it.
All right. So they're also, all engines are limited to 7,500 RPM, revolutions per minute, mm-hmm. compression ratio 10 to 1. They also have a little bit of variance in their horsepower. Did you notice that?
A little bit, but you know what?
Only like 620 to 650.
It's super high. Well, you just said it. Yeah, that's
it. I just slapped the cat out of the bag.
That's all right. I mean, man, these things are powerful, aren't they?
Yes, especially considering the way around 3,100 pounds or, you know, 1410 kilograms.
Mm-hmm.
So this kind of power is... It's fair to say it's not what you would expect from a saloon car.
I mean, 650 horsepower
right?
in these cars. It's amazing. And you know that, you know, these things, they're lightened in different ways. So they're not as heavy as a typical, like a similar road car would be with all of the extra equipment they've got.
Right.
Where they're adding weight, they're also taking off weight. So you mentioned the weight. I think you said it was around 3,000 pounds.
Yeah. And that's counting driver, I think.
Okay. Yeah. I've got a couple stats about that too. But, I don't even know if I'll be able to find that note in my pile here, but there are also restrictions on certain components, like the engine has to weigh a certain amount. I think it's 200 kilograms.
Yeah.
The driver and his suit and his seat mm-hmm. and the attachment points and everything has to weigh, I think it's 100 kilograms. And that's kind of a minimum weight. You can weigh more, of course.
Yeah.
But it's to the team's benefit to keep it as close to that 100 kilograms as possible.
And all cars run on E85 fuel. And then you can use a couple of different fuel tank sizes, depending mm-hmm. on the competition. So at the Sandown 500 or something, there would be a 112 liter tank, but for a longer, excuse me, I misspoke here, Scott. 112 liter tank is the rule. For longer events like the Sandown 500, a 120 liter tank is used because they're longer distances.
Fair enough. Yeah, they have what's called sprint car races, which mm-hmm. are sprint races, I guess. And then they also have endurance events. Now, the sprint races are typically like on a race weekend. They may have four qualifying races and then four actual races. Mm-hmm. And those races are shorter distances so that there's no pit stops involved. It's just flat out the whole way from start to finish. They do a standing start, a lot like you'd see in Formula One. Mm-hmm. And then, this just from beginning to end, they're on the track the entire time. There's no need for a pit stop unless it's a mechanical issue. Like they need to come in for rain tires or something like that. Or if they have low oil pressure and they want to come in and check that out or whatever happens.
Sure.
But it's normally just an all out, flat out race, and which makes it really exciting.
Yes. And we would be remiss if we didn't point out who else was in this race right now before we get to just the V8 history.
Mm-hmm.
So we already said Ford, we already said Holden, Mercedes-Benz is in here as well.
Yeah, that's brand new too.
Yeah, and that's a brand new one. Nissan Altima, Nissan, I don't know why I said Nisa. Nissan Altima, the L33. Anytime one of these is made, they have to be eligible to compete in this race as ranked by the organization.
Sure. What you just mentioned, we said that, it was set up early on, to be pretty much catered to the Ford Falcons and the GM,
the
Holden Commodores.
Yeah.
I keep wanting to say GM, but it's Holden, really.
Yeah.
Well, it's a division of anyways. That's what I mean when I say that anyway. So I'll probably mix up Holden and GM a couple times. But, they were the ones producing these 5-liter V8 four-door production sedans already. So it's a logical jump for them. But other manufacturers weren't able to get in on this. And, up until just this year, in 2013, Nissan came through with a factory sponsored team, with their Altima, which they were able to enter in the series, and a racing team called Erebus Racing, entered three Mercedes-Benz E63 AMGs, which now also qualify for the series. And in 2014, it looks like Volvo is going to be able to enter, with the S60 model that they have. So, it went from a two car series or two constructor series to a four constructor series, and now it's going to be up to a five constructor series as of next year. So the competition just seems to be getting better and better in this as we go along, which is important for a series.
Yeah, and I think that speaks to the future of the series as well as the excitement gathering about it. Now, one thing that we should also mention is that some of these regulations we're talking about, when we talk about control components and stuff like that, these new entries to the race this year, Mercedes-Benz and Nissan, their entries coincide with a change in the overall regulations for the cars. And you know what I'm talking about.
I do. They've added a bunch of these control units, control parts, rather.
Right.
These mandated parts that we talked about.
Right, because originally it was Project Blueprint regulations, and now it's moved to what they call the car of the future.
Exactly. And you know what? Man, we keep getting ahead, but we're going to go to the history, I promise, in just a moment, because, man, the history's getting pushed way back to the end of this podcast. Isn't
Sorry,
that kind of crazy?
I keep throwing monkey wrenches.
No, that's all right. It's good, because I just have a quick list and not a whole lot to say about this, but the control parts that we mentioned, we've already said the chassis, right?
Yeah.
There's also control electronics, which is the ECU or the power distribution model. The axles are control parts. The rear suspension. But they don't mention the front as being a control part, which is kind of odd, but.
I think that the rear suspension is in there specifically because they're rear wheel drive.
Mm, could be,
but,
yeah.
Also the clutch, right?
The clutch is another one, that's right. And, the wheels and tires. So they have aluminum wheels of a certain size, tires that have to be provided by the series sponsor, which is Dunlop. They also have a steering column, which is, another control part, which is, I guess, collapsible in the engine compartment area.
Makes
instead
sense.
It's not collapsible inside the cabin. Fire extinguisher system, so that, if there's something wrong, they flip the switch, it extinguishes anything, fills the car with foam or whatever it does. Chassis and roll cage, we mentioned chassis already, but there's a roll cage also. And, these can be built by different people, the chassis and roll cage, but they have to, be approved or scrutineered by the series and say that, yeah, these conform to our standards. These are exactly the way that they should be. So these regulation parts, they're the same for all competitors. These control parts, they ensure quality, for all the competitors, because they're all the same. It's not like some team's going to go out there with a lower budget and, risk the driver in some way, in some safety way.
Yeah.
Which they definitely don't want to do. And they do allow, I should mention that they do allow for minor differences between manufacturers and engine And body shapes to retain the look of production cars. So, you know, there are slight variations that are allowed here and there. And we know all about, you know, rule bending a little bit, you know, like through NASCAR specifically.
Finding the loophole.
Exactly. And that's exactly what these teams do as well. So, you know, it's still very exciting racing. It's not like every car is exactly identical. It's not like the IROC series or something like that, you know, where you know, it's just really
clone racing.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, there's a lot of driver skill involved, and they do try to level the playing field in this series as well. But, you know, manufacturers are free to kind of tinker around a little bit. But if they're found outside of the allowed rules or regulations or sizes or whatever restriction happens to be on that part or piece, yeah, they're fined or they're excluded from the
race. They're out of there.
Exactly. So they know better than to do something, you know, just horrendous.
Scott.
Yes.
I want to say that without further ado, we should stop letting me interrupt you and start doing the history of V8.
All right. We haven't even talked about the Dunlop series yet either. So I guess maybe we should do that. But you know what? I think maybe if you and I were attending an event, if you and I were going to a supercar event, a V8 supercar event,
yeah,
I'd want to look my best.
Yeah, man, I would too. And I wanted to talk to you about that because we, you know, we're all right. We're not like the worst dressed people in our part of the United States or something.
I don't think so.
We're close to the bottom of the list on some days. And, that can all change for us because we found out about a little website called Jack Threads.
Mm-hmm, that's right. And it's an online shopping destination. And it's kind of a club. It's like an online shopping club. And that may not appeal to you at first. Mm-hmm. But then when you understand that there are deep, deep discounts to be had, like up to 80% off, then that's when, you know, your ears might perk up.
Right. And this isn't on some knockoff, you know, Reebok with four E's or something like that. These are name brands that would ordinarily be much more expensive. So we're talking things like Penguin, mm-hmm. right?
Kenneth Cole.
Sure. Busted Tees.
Vans.
We're talking about quite a few things that you would recognize. They also sell accessories in addition to the clothing. And Scott, going back to your point about it being kind of a club, a bit exclusive, there is a waiting list to be part of jackthreads.com.
Yeah, that's right. But you can skip that membership wait list if you want. I mean, if you know us, which you do, I mean, just via listening to this program, right? All you have to do to gain instant access to Jack Threads is you go to jackthreads.com/carstuff when you sign up and skip the waiting list. You're in for free. You're able to peruse the whole, you know, everything that's available, shop, do whatever you want, look around for stuff, accessories, clothes, shoes, glasses, whatever.
And no need to thank us. We just do this kind of stuff because we're buddies.
Ah, we're good guys.
We're all right, you know?
Yeah, and you know what? I think, you know, if you made a trip to jackthreads.com before you went to the V8 supercar event, you'd be looking pretty good.
Yeah, I think that's pretty good advice. And now, with that being said, we return.
Yeah.
Finally, to our long-delayed history.
Finally. We're getting into the history of this whole thing, and it's usually the part that we start with, right?
It is.
But you know what? It kind of makes sense that we talked about the cars themselves because they're so exciting. I mean, it's just there's so much about the series that it's just really cool to watch. I've been watching video clips of this all week now.
Yes. To your point, Scott, it reminds me of earlier in the show when we were saying, all right, sedan cars / saloon cars, I know it sounds like you don't want to see it, but trust us, ladies and gentlemen, when you check out these vehicles, it's not your garden variety sedan.
No, definitely not. It's anything but that. And the history goes back, as you mentioned, you know, in the mid-90s, let's say. That's when it starts, right?
Right, yeah.
And I guess we can start, we can kind of jump right in with something called the Australian V8 Supercar Company, which was shortened. They called themselves Avesco. And they formed in 1996 to run the series. And without getting into all the politics of who owns what share or whatever, it was a joint venture between The Touring Car Entrance Group of Australia, which is TEGA, or T-E-G-A. The sports promoter is IMG, which I think everybody probably knows who IMG is. You see that everywhere in sporting events still. Mm-hmm. And the Australian Motorsports Commission. So all three of those partners came together, to form this Avesco, which is the Australian V8 supercar company. Now the series name in 1996 was officially the V8 Supercars, and that's going to change as we talk about this. So that's important. It was just called V8 Supercars initially. And that was officially, well, initially it was part of the Australian Touring Car Championship Series. Mm-hmm. And then the series expanded in 1998, and then in 1999, they added endurance races and,
Control tires.
Yeah, right? Control tires. That's when the control tires first came in, but it was a different supplier then. It was Bridgestone at the time.
Yeah.
As you know now, it's Dunlop. And then again in 1999, the series name changed to the Shell Championship Series, and that's of course due to a sponsorship via Shell. So they changed the entire name of the series to the Shell Championship Series, and that maintained until about 2002. So it went about 3 years there.
Yeah.
And then the control tire supplier changed to Dunlop, and the series was once again renamed to the V8 Supercar Championship Series, which it remains the same until today. And that's obviously because Shell dropped out of sponsorship at that point in 2002. So, 2002, there's some big things happening with the Dunlop, Dunlop taking over the tires and the renaming to the V8 Supercar Championship Series.
And I've got a few more historical points to add on that if you want to.
Sure. Yeah. Let's do that.
Okay. As we lead into Dunlop. So, let's see, 2005, to follow up on some of the international events we had talked about.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, wait, yes. I see the note you're holding up.
I am holding a note to stop before you get to 2005 because I have a little note that goes back to 2003, and I think we should just mention it.
Project Blueprint, right?
Project Blueprint, yeah. I don't know how much you have on this, so I'll just go ahead and read what I've got.
You can
interrupt if you want, Ben.
Sure.
But something called Project Blueprint was set about in 2003, and that was basically a new set of regulations that was, again, to level the playing field. Holden had pretty much dominated the series in 98 and 99, and so much so that Ford had threatened to withdraw from the series. Now, they didn't withdraw, but Holden continued to dominate in 2001 and 2002. So you can imagine that Ford is saying, like, what's going on here? We can't compete. There's got to be a way to kind of level out what's going on here, because I think GM was probably investing a ton of money in this because they were dominating.
Right, and they were investing, also Ford was investing a ton of money, maybe not by the comparison, but racing is expensive.
And they're trying to keep up.
Yeah, and they don't want to invest a bunch of money to look bad. So these two guys, Wayne Kadich and Paul Taylor, mm-hmm. are the folks who spent several years designing a universal formula that would get rid of some of the, I guess, discrepancies or between their designs,
yeah.
Holden and Ford.
Exactly, to level out the playing field between the Fords and the Holdens. And part of this formula was the common chassis, of course.
Mm-hmm.
The same wheelbase dimensions were then added. They had to have the same wheelbase, whether that meant lengthening the cars or shortening the cars.
Mm-hmm.
Also, suspensions were kind of evened out as well, like we mentioned earlier. The seating positions had to be the same. They were lowered, and they had to be exactly the same in each car so that, the center of gravity was the same. Aerodynamic packages, they were added added to, to kind of level things out as well. And the engine porting differences were made similar. So, mm-hmm. The engines were not exactly identical, but similar enough that, that they could still play around with them, but still, there's room for a little bit of mechanics to do their magic there.
Yeah. And this formula, by the way, continued to undergo an evolution,
mm-hmm.
throughout the next few years leading up to 2013, which I think we've already mentioned. That's when the overall formula changed, probably to allow for more constructors in the business.
But you were going to say something about 2005, right?
Yes. Thank you, Scott. I digressed. This is a big year in 2005 because the competition, the series, moves out internationally. Now, gave me a little tinge of recognition when we mentioned the foray into China, right?
Mm-hmm.
I know the story of what happened. It was supposed to be a 5-year agreement, but unfortunately, things didn't work out with the promoter of the race. So the series didn't return after that. However,
interesting. I wonder if it was popular among the people there, if they really liked the series, or if it just, you know, it was just a conflict with the promoter himself and or herself.
Yeah.
And didn't work out.
I should dig deeper on that
and
see what's going on there. But also, in 2006, the very next year, they're at Bahrain in the Bahrain International Circuit. And we've mentioned, New Zealand. We've mentioned also the United States, Abu Dhabi in 2010. So the Middle East is being a returning point right there.
So these have been all around the world.
Right. These have been all around the world. So FIA gave them international status, what's called international status, in 2011. And this means that the series can present itself to race at up to 6 international venues annually.
Not bad.
So that's not bad at all. Mm-hmm. And then we go to, let's see, we're moving up to 2013. Let's see, which thread do we pick up first?
Oh, well, that's the, this is interesting because around 2013, is when kind of another dream came to fruition, I guess, is maybe the best way to say it. And, you know, these groups of one, you know, when things are kind of going along the same for a long time, they say, well, what are we going to do to kind of mix things up? Well, they developed what they called the Car of the Future. And the Car of the Future, which was kind of, it was revealed in, I think, 2011, as a matter of fact, but it wasn't put into practice until 2013. So this year is really the first year of the Car of the Future to be on the track. But the Car of the Future project was designed, it's got a couple of objectives. And I went to the main site here, v8supercars.com.au,
yeah,
to find out, you know, what exactly the project is designed to do. And, well, laid it out for me right there in front. I mean, it was like 4 or 5 bullet points. So I guess I'll just read a couple of these. To ensure the long-term viability and growth of the sport, open up V8 supercars to new manufacturers to compete, which it did with the Nissan and the Mercedes teams. Make cars cheaper to build and repair, which I've got some stats on that, as a matter of fact, how much it costs to build one of these things. And make cars safer, lighter, and stronger. Always good for racing, right?
Right.
Increase the motoring market relevance of V8 supercars, so that's to be able to sell the cars on the street. Maintain the DNA of V8 supercars, which, you know, they already had in place, and they wanted to maintain that for their series. You know, V8 engines, rear-wheel drive, things like that. Also to increase the number of V8 supercar events in a condensed calendar across multiple countries.
Mm-hmm.
Tough saying that one, but they want to really expand where they race in the world.
Yeah.
They want to really make it a worldwide event. And the last thing that they said is they want to ensure higher quality racing. So, you know, it's not intended to slow things down or anything like that. It's intended to make the series a better series to watch, a better series to drive in, a better series for teams to be able to build cars in.
Mm-hmm. It's a long-term play.
Yeah, and I mentioned the cost, and I'll just quickly tell you here that, you know, the Car of the Future, that the regulations are reducing the cost of building a car for the teams really dramatically. If you look at the differences here. Now, I'll give you the price now and the price that it used to be.
Okay.
The cost right now with the Car of the Future, the cost to build a car without an engine is around $250,000. That's the chassis. That's like a rolling chassis. So no engine at all in that.
All right. That's just the shell, pretty much.
I mean, that's everything you need. All the electronics, everything else except for the engine.
Okay.
And the engine itself is going to cost you about $50,000.
So we're looking about $300,000 total.
Correct. And that's with the new Car of the Future design as of 2013. Now, prior to this, it used to cost about $450,000 to build a car without an engine. And the engine itself was down, it cost about $120,000.
Right.
So it went from $570,000 for an average car, you know, that's just one car, down to about $300,000, as you mentioned. So that's a huge savings for teams.
Yeah, especially for starting off teams.
Yeah, right. You could have two cars for the price of one,
mm-hmm.
you know, with this new Car of the Future. A lot of teams are able to jump on that and you know, definitely make the team bigger, better, stronger, you know, whatever it takes.
Yeah, and speaking of teams, some of the ways that the teams work, the teams can consist of one to four cars.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the teams that have one car have an alliance with a two-car team of some sort. And these racers are gauged on a point system. So mm-hmm. you'll hear about the Drivers' Championship. That title is given to the individual driver who gets the most points over the season.
Mm-hmm.
So this can be in multiple events. And usually when it comes to scoring points for team championships, you know, that's where the champion team gets the most points over the season.
The manufacturers or the teams? Yeah, I guess both.
Yeah. Teams that have four cars are separated into pairs mm-hmm. of double car teams. So,
sure.
So with this point system, we can see that there is a huge interest in running the whole series, not just one event.
Well, we can't get into, you know, how many points for each thing and each lap and all that, because
right.
it gets really complex, especially when you talk about these teams are sometimes they're racing in four events every weekend. You know, so the points swing in this, swings dramatically, you know, between who's ahead, who's in the lead. I mean, you could easily climb up the scale, just by doing well in one weekend.
Right.
So, you know, and consistency is always important in these types of things. You know, when it's a long series, long events, I guess long schedule is what I mean.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, if you're consistently in the top three, five, whatever, you're definitely going to be high in the points. So that's always a good thing. And there's a lot of information out there about who's leading right now, because we're, you know, later in the series.
Right.
You know, they've already had their Texas event here in the United States that we mentioned early on in this thing. And,
sure.
and apparently, Ben, that was a big success, at the Circuit of Americas.
Yeah.
I guess, they said that, you know, the plan is to return for another season for 2014. So, turned out real well. I think the crowd attendance was something like 68,000 for a 3-day event, which
wow.
is actually really, really good for them. Again, they're talking about multi-year deals that they're kind of throwing around. The president and CEO of the Texas track is saying, you know, we're definitely considering multi-year deals. So, I mean, again, the question was, will the V8 supercars return in 2014? I think the answer is going to be yes.
And that's the name of that is the Austin 400, right?
Yeah, that was the specific race. And, you know, they have just a ton of good races. And one thing
yeah.
I want to mention is they race at a track, the event is rather called the Bathurst 1000.
Ah, yes.
In New South Wales. And there have been some requests for us to do a podcast
just on that, right?
Strictly on that track, that event, on the Bathurst track.
Mm-hmm.
Cause there's a lot of history with that one as well.
And it's one of those longer races in comparison to the other races.
That's one of the endurance events,
yeah.
I believe. Yeah. I'll just
You're
check
right.
my schedule real quick here. But I think it is. Yeah. Yes,
and,
it is.
And so there's a wealth of races here. I'm glad that you brought this up. There's also another supercar series that we have been putting off talking about.
Yeah.
And that is the Dunlop V8 supercar.
Yeah. And this is, I guess, the best way to look at this. And I've been trying to figure out how to word this, but, it's really like the second tier series to the V8 supercars. And again, it's just adding the word Dunlop at the beginning, but the Dunlop V8 Supercar Series, and it's run kind of as a support race to the V8 Supercars, like
right.
And I kind of see this similar to like the Firestone Indy Light Series to the IndyCar Series.
Yeah, I think that's a good comparison. It's almost a feeder series when it comes to the drivers.
Yeah, that's right. Because you know, a lot of these are what they call gentleman racers. You know, the guys that they come out and, you know, they've got a lot of money and they field this race team and they just race on the weekend. They've got other jobs. You know, they're bankers, they're investors.
The other word is privateers.
Privateers. That's right. I mean, but a lot of teams will specifically target or specifically, recruit young drivers that they see with a lot of talent,
mm-hmm.
and they'll use this as a training series because, you know, it's really the same thing. I mean, and this series has been around since 2000.
Mm-hmm.
The difference is that they run in slightly older cars. They're the same cars, really, but they're mm-hmm. older cars. They're smaller teams, lower budgets, and it's really now it's only two cars because, you know, it's the Fords and the Holdens that we mentioned before because they run older cars and, you know, it's the smaller series. The Nissans and the Mercedes haven't yet made it into the Dunlop series.
Yeah, and that'll probably be a few years from now.
I think so. I mean, but the main focus behind this is that a lot of up and coming talent in the Dunlop mm-hmm. series, they kind of get noticed for potential, you know, driver spots in the bigger V8 supercar series. So this can be the springboard that launches a lot of young drivers up into the big time, into the pros.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
This is it has a real purpose other than being entertaining for everybody. And, you know, that, you know, it's really exciting to watch as well because it's really the same thing. It's just older cars, slightly less horsepower, I believe. They don't have the 650 horsepower, I don't think, as the bigger cars. I've got to double check that for sure. But there are 31 drivers, 17 teams, you know, two different types of cars, I guess, are competing.
Right.
But still, the racing action is very exciting. It's very fast.
Yes, and think about it. If you get a chance to check out one of those races, that you might be watching the next champion of the V8 Supercar Series.
It's very possible. I mean, when I mentioned the Indy Light Series, I mean, a lot of drivers have come up from Indy Lights up into the IndyCar Series and then become champions. And the
yep.
same with, let's say that you take NASCAR, because that's more of a direct comparison here
yeah.
between these cars, really. You think about, like, the Nationwide Series that they run, which is, like, the smaller, less than the Sprint Cup Series that they have. Am I mixing up the terms? I think that's right. The NASCAR, the big series.
Yeah.
They graduate up to that level and then of course they become champions. So, mm-hmm. Yeah, watch what's going on in the Dunlop V8 Supercar Series as well, because those drivers are ones you'll see highlighted later.
And that's relatively, the thing is it's not that much younger than the V8 series proper, right? Because
yeah.
V8 proper comes out, it's not fair to call V8 proper, I guess, but supercar series in general, out in 1997. By 2000, just 3 years later, mm-hmm. that's when we see Dunlop on the scene.
Sure, they noticed a need for, you know, some type of other support series to run along with this and a chance for, you know, like we said, you know, the smaller teams, the lower budgets, to get involved in this type of racing. And it's fantastic to watch. It's really fun. Mm-hmm. So, man, I think, I don't know how much more I have. I mean, there's a lot of television coverage.
Yeah.
We just don't get it here in the States. We don't get, any kind of supercar coverage here. Where they do get coverage is in Australia, of course.
Sure.
Africa, Asia, Brazil, Europe, Latin America, the Middle East. Just a little, and you know what? Actually, I'm going to say that we do get some here, but you have to pay for it. It's a pay channel, pay-per-view type situation. And I think we were only able to get the Texas race.
Right.
So, we were only able to watch the race that's happening here in America, but, you know, in New Zealand, of course, they're a pay event as well. Some of these are free, you know, that they're normal broadcasts, you know, like live events. But man, Ben, I tell you, this whole series, I mean, it's so cool that, you know, they run on road courses only, so there's no mm-hmm. oval tracks like in NASCAR, mm-hmm. but it's similar to NASCAR in a way that there's a lot of bumping, a lot of nudging, you know, a little bit of pushing is involved, and allowed, you know, that
right.
they kind of know that they can do that. It's closed wheel, so there's no super speedway races or anything like that. It's road courses, which are just really exciting. They can be on tracks that run through cities, which are really, really tight, and
yep.
that makes for intense, intense racing.
Mm-hmm.
Great V8 sounds, which, you know, you and I love that a lot. We,
right.
we both love the sound of racing. I don't know, just there's, like I said, a lot of contact between the cars, so, you know, there's a lot of bumping and nudging, and that's all kind of fun. And with these shorter sprint-style races that we mentioned, the ones that are just flat out racing from beginning to end, and then they know that they've got a pit stop between races.
Mm.
It makes for extremely exciting event because, you know, they just go all out. There's no holding back.
And, almost 1.9 million people saw this over 2012.
Wow.
So I assume that number is going to rise when we see the close of 2013. And in the future, they're adding some more international
Wait, you're
races.
Saying 1.9 million people attended the events, right?
Yeah, over
that's,
2012.
So they actually drove to an event and attended this live. That's a huge audience.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, and the global potential reach for television on the website is quoted as up to 500 million.
Whoa.
So this is a big deal.
It
and
is.
And it's going to keep expanding, including some races in Korea, Hong Kong, Singapore, apparently. You know, when I think of Singapore, my first guess is, do they have room?
race? Yeah, you wouldn't think so.
Pretty crowded place.
Yeah.
But I guess so is Hong Kong.
Sure.
And South Africa. So there, that's just among a few. So what we can see in the future for this series is, I think, growth. I think enormous growth, pretty robust at least, because people love racing. It's going to all the right places. I hope, as a fan, I hope that it will come to more American venues.
I do too. I mean, touring car has always been big overseas.
Yeah.
And it tried it here in the mid-90s, as we mentioned, with the North American touring car.
Yeah, briefly.
It was briefly, and it just didn't hang around long enough. You know, it was a couple of years, a couple of seasons, mm-hmm. and it didn't catch on. I'm really hoping that people kind of gravitate towards this V8 supercar series, because it's exciting racing to watch. And if you haven't, you know, go online, check out some clips. I think there's even one that's called, like, the V8 supercars best last lap ever or something.
Yeah.
That, if you watch that clip and you're not hooked on the series, I don't know what to tell you, because it's exciting.
Yeah, and I'm glad you mentioned YouTube, because realistically, that is probably one of the best ways for U.S. race fans to get a look at this kind of action.
Yeah, or, you know, there's one other source that's pretty good, and they do kind of a race wrap-up on, if you go to their main website, which is V8,
oh, that's right.
If you go to v8supercars.com.au, you can look at, you know, the news section, or, you know, I forget exactly where it is, but you can get kind of a highlight of the weekend's events, and you can go through the entire season and watch, you know, here's race one, and here's what happened. It's just a recap. It doesn't have the excitement of watching just a single last lap clip with the announcers, you know, with you and I have talked about last lap excitement and how much the announcers play into that.
Mm-hmm.
When you're watching a summary, it's kind of, it's a little more bland, but it gives you a good idea of what happened in the event, and also shows you all the different tracks that they attend, and exactly what's going on in the series.
And we have to do one last thing, Scott, before we wrap up.
What's that?
That is to thank Lee and Dallas for their excellent suggestion.
Yeah, thanks a lot. Now I'm hooked.
Yeah. And I guess we'll be in Austin, so we're going to go ahead and get out of here and try to plan our trip. And I think we've got enough time to figure this out.
I think so, if it's a year away still, right?
Yeah, maybe we can get our bosses to pay for it.
Not quite a year.
All right, so while Scott and I are trying to lay on our charm for a trip to the Austin 400, why don't you let us know what you think of V8 supercar racing, especially if you attended one of the events live. You can drop us a line on Facebook or Twitter. You can suggest new upcoming topics. Hey, if you have a gently used Holden Commodore that you're trying to get off your hands, you can also email us directly at
carstuff@discovery.com.
For more on this and thousands of other topics, visit howstuffworks.com. Let us know what you think. Send an email to podcast@howstuffworks.com.